listening to a short cast from the London School of Economics and Political Science, Shaping the Post-COVID World series, a digested version of our live online public event series. This event was recorded on 18th February 2021. A full version is available to download via the LSE website or from your usual podcast provider.
Hello, everyone. A very warm welcome to the LSE for this online event to all of you, wherever you are. My name is Eric Neumeier. I'm a professor in the Department of Geography and Environment, though currently I'm the Pro Director Planning and Resources at the school. I am very pleased to be here to welcome Professor Naila Kabir for this very first lecture in our new series organized in memory of our colleague, Professor Sylvia Chand, who very sadly died about 1 year and 2 months ago. But now to today's event. Naila is Professor of Gender and Development at the Department of Gender Studies and also the Department of International Development here at the LSE. In her lecture today, Naila will use a feminist economic lens to analyze a range of different impacts associated with COVID-19 and to explore the kinds of policies that such a lens would suggest for a more resilient and equitable future. But now I'm delighted to hand over to you, Naila.
I will be sharing what we as feminist economists have to contribute to the ongoing conversation about COVID-19. I will be drawing on contributions to a special issue of feminist economics on this topic, which will be online very soon and will be open access till July. First of all, I should say that while gender is the entry point for all our discussions, it is now more than ever embedded in an intersectional understanding of inequality, of the way in which gender intersects with inequalities of class, ethnicity, race, and so on. And of course, such an intersectional perspective is imperative in times of COVID. We have become all too aware that while the virus itself might be blind to your identity, your nationality, and so on, risks of infection and your ability to cope with the infection varies considerably. And it reveals inequalities that we knew were there, but we somehow did not comprehend them as fully as we might have. And these inequalities have become exacerbated in the times of COVID, to the extent that they may have long-lasting implications, if we don't do something about them, for social unrest and deteriorating rights. However, there's another outcome of this crisis, which I hope will have a long-lasting effect, and that it will hold the key to building a fairer economy in the future. And that is that the crisis has drawn attention to forms of work that are essential in our daily lives, much of which we took for granted when we look back on what we now call normal times. All the major crises that have happened in recent years have revealed various fault lines in society between groups of workers who were more or less vulnerable to losing their jobs. This crisis has revealed a very different set of fault lines. Some recognized officially, others unacknowledged. The first and most widely recognized is between essential workers whose work must continue during the pandemic and non-essential workers whose activity has been brought to a halt or relocated to the homes. Essential workers are those whose services are necessary for us to continue in our daily life and to save our health and lives. They include well-paid professionals such as doctors and scientists and public health officials, but the vast majority are made up of low-wage service workers, normally deemed unskilled, but now recognized as essential to ensure the sale and delivery of hosts of goods and services, cleaning, home health, garbage disposal, the post, and so on. But amongst essential workers, too, there is a fault line, one that goes largely unremarked. And that is between paid and unpaid essential work. Although it is carried out as routinely as paid essential work and is as critical to everyday life as paid essential work, the work of those who undertake care work and household work within the home has remained largely invisible during this pandemic, even though the burden of this work has increased. And among non-essential workers, too, there are fault lines. There are fault lines between those of us, like me, who can continue to work from home because I have access to necessary technology, and those of us who can't. And among those of us who can't, the more fortunate live in countries where they may get some kind of support from their governments. The less fortunate live in countries where they have to fend for themselves. So turning now to labor markets, one of the big contributions I think that feminist economists have made to the analysis of inequalities in labor markets is in relation not to the way that individuals fare in the labor market, but how individuals as members of groups fare. And so it is through the segmentation of the labor market that we get to understand inequality. And this segmentation has helped to explain the disproportionate impacts that have been experienced by women as a result of two kinds of disruptions of labor markets. On the one hand, job losses in sectors that have been hardest hit by the shutdown, and on the other hand, overrepresentation in frontline jobs that have to continue. Globally, around 40% of all women workers, compared to about 36% of men, work in services that were hardest hit economically by the pandemic: tourism, hotel and food services, wholesale and retail trade, labor-intensive manufacturing. In fact, rapid assessments in the Asia-Pacific region has shown that women's overrepresentation in these hardest hit sectors means that they have lost out most in terms of working hours and in terms of jobs. On the other hand, women are also overrepresented in the essential frontline work. Over 70% of women globally are in healthcare and social services. Labor market segmentation also explains the intersectional nature of the impacts of the pandemic, with gender intersecting with race, ethnicity, class, disability, and so on, to show up in patterns of unemployment. In the United States, not only did unemployment rates for women exceed those of men, so far during the early years of pandemic, but they were even higher for Hispanic and Black women. In South Africa, the lockdown led to substantial declines in employment and working hours for both men and women. Job losses were larger for the African population than non-African, for the lowest income tercile compared to higher ones, and for the less educated compared to the more educated. And in each one of these categories, job losses were larger for women than for men. Amongst informal workers, we find greater vulnerability amongst some workers than others. So for millions of domestic workers, labor market setbacks and income insecurities have been extremely acute. And of course, 80% of domestic workers who clean and cook and so on are women. Domestic workers' unions have talked about the violations of workers' rights, not being able to leave employers' homes, having their leave cancelled with no notice. But these violations are most acute, of course, for international migrant workers, many of them who are domestics. They are caught between different degrees of lockdown in their home and host countries, leaving many without jobs and in a legal limbo. Those on sponsorship visas have been hardest hit. But of course, in some countries, internal migrants have been reminded of their unequal status. In the Indian context, of course, the abrupt imposition of lockdown measures, the closure of all establishments and restrictions on public transport left nearly 500,000 internal migrants without any work, forced to return home, walking several hundreds of miles, and many dying on the way. Turning now to contestations within the home, feminists have analyzed households and families as sites of cooperation intermeshed with conflict, sites of care and intimacy, as well as power, inequality, and violence. The analysis of domestic institutions and labor markets have tended to be carried out separately. You have people who work on households and people who work on labor markets, but the COVID disruptions have reminded us of the interconnections between the two. Disruptions in the economy have had profound reverberations within the home, while struggles to manage their consequences within the home, when homes are overcrowded, when the capacity to do homeschooling is undermined by other stresses, will have important implications for resilience and recovery. Research during the pandemic has trained a spotlight on the household's role in the unpaid care economy. Women continue to do the bulk of routine household and care work in much of the world, but there are variations in the extent to which men have increased their contributions to non-routine domestic work. Lockdowns and stay-at-home orders appear to have increased unpaid workloads. There was one contribution in our special issue that suggested that there had been a shift to a more gender egalitarian division of labor within the home during lockdown. This was in Spain, but there was a selection bias in that it focused on individuals with higher levels of education and access to internet. In these households, they found that a significant proportion of couples had moved towards a much greater egalitarianism, but a significant minority remained within the old norms, with women taking up the bulk of domestic labor. The more common pattern has been one of the disproportionate burden of unpaid work falling on women. The fallout from COVID and its impact on unpaid care has obviously had secondary health impacts in terms of both mental and physical well-being. Both men and women report higher adverse impacts in terms of well-being, but women are much more likely to report it when they report an intensification of domestic and unpaid care work. They were much more likely to report a deterioration in their mental and physical and emotional well-being. And a very interesting example of this came from a study of doctors in Kazakhstan. This study actually started before COVID, so it was able to use a time series to see how things had changed after COVID. What it showed was a clear increase in levels of stress and anxiety and in health-related, in bad health behavior for doctors, but the gender difference was mediated by family structures, so that the effects on stress and anxiety was much higher for married women doctors with children compared to unmarried women doctors. It also increased the likelihood of married women doctors smoking, but it reduced the likelihood of poor eating habits. Among male doctors, stress, anxiety, and poor eating habits were higher among unmarried male doctors than married ones, whether the married ones had children or not. So clearly, marriage and children assure better eating habits amongst male doctors and reduce their levels of stress and anxiety, but increase the levels of stress and anxiety and smoking amongst female doctors. So the study highlights the stresses created by the dual role that professional mothers must balance, but it tells us that these stresses are exacerbated for women doctors in times of heightened anxieties of COVID. A number of the studies actually cast an interesting light on the later stages of the life course in mediating the experience of pandemic. One point